It's 10 p.m. Do you know where your children are?
The evidence was circumstantial, and the prosecution brought Wayne Williams to trial for two of the 28 killings.
Apartments on Buford Highway, where we now have new developments in the ongoing investigation of the Centennial Park bombing.
General Robert Abrams, for the first time, and officially calls the Tawana Brawler story a lie.
At a press conference this morning, Seattle Police Chief Robert Hansen announced a special task force being formed to study Ted Bundy.
Join us now as we go beyond criminal headlines.
And I'm your host for Beyond Criminal Headlines, Nicole Bennett. In fall 2023, investigators identified a 9-year-old girl's killer more than 50 years after she was abducted less than a block from her home in Marietta, Georgia. Debbie Lynn Randall, a third-grade student, vanished on January 13, 1972. She'd been on her way home from a nearby laundromat. As loved ones frantically searched for Debbie, they recall finding a spilled box of detergent on the ground next to a Volkswagen parked approximately 85 feet from the laundromat door. Debbie's body was found almost 2.5 weeks later after an extensive search by hundreds of people. She'd been sexually assaulted and strangled. Addressing reporters last September, Cobb County District Attorney Flynn Brody said after authorities discovered Debbie's body in 1972, detectives followed up on hundreds of leads before the case went cold. And thankfully, advances in DNA technology and forensic technology ultimately changed everything. During the original investigation, officers with the Marietta Police Department recovered a hair from the suspect and a piece of cloth. An October 2001 FBI test on the hair allowed investigators to rule out several potential suspects. And according to CBS News, in spring of 2015, the cloth recovered by authorities was sent to forensics for an updated analysis, which resulted in a partial DNA profile attributed to an unknown white male. Additional funding was obtained for testing in 2019, and the cloth was analyzed again in 2022. Florida's DNA Labs International was selected next to conduct further testing. And officials have since confirmed that DNA Labs International was able to find relatives of the suspect. Those relatives gave investigators additional DNA samples for comparison. And like I said, last fall, authorities landed on a man who hadn't been on their radar at any point during the investigation. 51 years. And the man's name was William Rose. William Rose was 24 years old at the time of the crime and committed suicide in 1974, just 2 years after Debbie's death. Retired Sergeant Morris Nix, who spent more than 10 years with the Kennesaw Police Department, was instrumental in closing Debbie's case. And he'll be quick to point out there were many people who were involved, but he was such a key part of the perseverance of this cold case unit. Sergeant Nix, who joined me virtually to talk about Debbie's case, began his law enforcement career in 1978 with the Cobb County Sheriff's Office and remained there until his retirement in June 2005. He was then hired by the Kennesaw Police Department in 2006 as the Internal Affairs Investigator and Polygraph Examiner. In addition to his work with the Kennesaw Police Department, Sergeant Nix assisted many other agencies in the area. One notable example, of course, was his involvement with Cobb County's cold case unit. He said on his very first day, he asked, "Who has Debbie Lynn Randall's case?" He remembered her disappearance in the 1970s. Unfortunately, no one on the unit had heard of her case. It had been so long, and most of the officers, with one or two exceptions, weren't from the Cobb County area originally. So he told them about Debbie. They went to Marietta, he said, hoping they still had some evidence. They go to the back of the evidence room, drag out a dusty box, open it up, and that was where his journey with Debbie's case officially began.
And Nicole, one of the first things that you have to learn if you're going to work a cold case as opposed to working an active case is you cannot beat yourself up over what was or was not done. That's the first thing you got to get past. And I tell people this all the time when I teach. Most of the time, the crime scenes are no longer there. In Debbie's case, everyone was deceased. Every time we'd run somebody down, they had died. Now, one of the original detectives on this case was Bill Hudson. He was at Marietta PD. He was a sergeant. He would later become Sheriff Bill Hudson in Cobb County, where he was sheriff for over 30 years. And I had all, even before this, I would talk to him about Debbie's case because I remember vividly the day that it happened. And that was kind of my beginning with doing this.
That's so you, like you said, I ask that of cold case detectives all the time is when you look back at a case, if you weren't one of the original investigators, what did you see that they, where were the missteps? Where were, you know, and so that's so interesting is to come outside of that box. And you can't get hung up on that. I think that's fascinating. So coming to Debbie's case or remembering that vividly, before we unpack what led up to her disappearance, again, January 13th, 1972, I was going to ask if you could tell us a little about Debbie and how her family and loved ones described her.
Well, where Debbie lived at that time was projects. It was a lot of, very middle class, lower income people. And everybody knew everybody. All the kids knew everybody. And Debbie was just a very normal little girl. She was pretty. She was smart. She had a lot of friends. She was well liked. I've often thought about her classmates because they had to deal with that when she came up missing. And I have thought of them often. But Debbie loved to play with dolls. And they would meet. And a lot of people don't really understand how Debbie came to be at the laundromat. Debbie was abducted from the laundromat, which was right there across the street. Now, she was probably 60 feet from her front door. I mean, she literally could yell back and forth across the street. And the girls would go there because they had nowhere else to go. And they would meet at the laundromat, play with dolls. And Debbie was over there on this day to do laundry. And her stepfather had given her the chain, got the machine started. And I talked to a girl who remembered the evening, it seemed rather well, and she was going to go home with Debbie. And her big sister said, "You're not going anywhere. You're going to stay here and help me fold clothes." And Debbie went out the door by herself and, of course, just vanishes. Now, one thing Debbie liked to do was get the detergent that was left in the laundromat. She would gather it up and take it to her mom. So she had a box of silver dust detergent. And when we went into that case file and opened up, the first thing I saw was that box. And if you look at, there is a photo of where the detergent was spilled. I don't know if you've seen it. But there is that photo. And if you look at where the photo lays out and where the detergent went, you know she resisted. There are a couple of things that trouble me for answers. One, whoever did this, were they alone? Did they know her? Did Debbie know this person? I know now that she did not. But these were the questions that really troubled me. And but Debbie was just a very normal little girl. And the tragedy was profound, as you can imagine. And I have always told people, this was Marietta's finest hour. In the middle of this tragedy, it was your finest hour. Thousands showed up. Everybody got involved. Marietta in 1972 was still a bedroom community to Atlanta. Everybody said, keep them across the river. That was the saying, talking about the Chattahoochee, which divides Fulton and Cobb County. Keep them on their side of the river. Well, you know, time goes on and things progress and property values change. And but everybody just really, really responded. And Debbie is buried probably a mile maybe from JonBenet Ramsey. And I would go by JonBenet's grave. And I don't really want to misunderstand what I'm saying. I'm internally grateful for all the publicity and attention she has gotten. Debbie was from the other side of the tracks, literally. Marietta, 1972, with a few exceptions, was pretty much two sides of the track. And Debbie was not from that side. I would go to JonBenet's, and then I would go to Debbie's, and I would just think, what a contrast. So I was determined to put it out there as much as I could. This is one thing you have to understand, and I teach this in my class. When you work a cold case, you have to keep it in front of the public because they forget. You know, things happen, time, and they forget. With that, you have to understand there's going to come some criticism because people are going to say, well, are you making it about you? And that was never the case. I didn't care who did the interviews. I didn't care whose name was in the paper. None of us on that cold case unit were about that. And I wanted people to understand this is about keeping Debbie's case out there.
Absolutely. And that was something I was going to ask you is, you know, as your investigation got underway, you say you remember the day so vividly that she disappeared. And years later, you're working on this as a cold case. What were your feelings as you started your investigation? And immediately I was going to ask you, what were red flags that stood out? Were there any, I mean, witness statements from 1972 that caught your eye? What were your first steps as you started to investigate her case?
Well, I remember the day vividly, and this was on Friday the 13th. I came home, see my mom. She was standing at the kitchen window, and she was wringing her hands, and she was really, I knew something was wrong. And I said, Mom, well, you know, what's wrong? What are you upset about? And she started telling me about this little girl that was missing. So that, I just remember that so well. And when I first went in the case file, this day and time, Nicole, when we have this type of crime, there's thousands of photographs. There's video. There's so much recorded information. 1972, there wasn't. When I went in that box, I thought I was going to find probably a couple hundred photographs. I think I found five or six Polaroid photographs. So I knew I had to start running down the headlines from the paper. And there were a lot of newspaper articles. This had gotten quite a bit of national attention, but I knew I had to start gathering information that was going to be hard to find. So again, we started trying to contact people involved with the case, and they were all deceased. Captain Bill Elliott, who was the first person to take this case, was deceased. I found his wife and his son, hoping that perhaps they had something that we didn't know about. They didn't. Sheriff Hudson could not really tell me anything more specific because he didn't remember. It had been, you know, by this time now we're looking at 40, 5 years. So, and Nicola, I want to thank people who always kept it positive, who always said, you know, don't give up. Because there were some naysayers that said, why are you doing this? You're never going to know who did this. You need to accept it. Get over it. You're too emotionally attached to this case, you know, blah, blah, blah. But I thought, and I knew early on, this was going to be a DNA case. So when we first started looking at the material that we had, we thought, well, if we have DNA, is it, you know, degraded? Can we use it? And back then, and I say back then as if it was that long ago, it's not, but you couldn't do what you can do now. So we said, well, let's give it a shot. And I remember thinking, if we get nothing on this DNA, this is going to be difficult, if not impossible. Everybody kept telling me, well, you know, he's probably dead, you know. Bob. I said, well, he could be, but then again, if he was early in his 20s, he's going to be alive. And the more people pushed back, the harder I pushed back, because I just thought, I'm not giving up until, you know, we're not going to quit till it's time to quit. You know, Yogi Berra would say, it ain't over till it's over. Looking at this, and when I first started going through it, we had quite a few names in the file. So we had submitted the DNA. Now, what had happened was this person, who we now know, William Rose, there's a couple of theories.
And jumping in here to give you some context on those theories, Dr. Larry Howard with the Georgia State Crime Lab examined Debbie's body after it was found in 1972. And just as important, a geologist also studied the dirt on Debbie's clothing and determined it was from Dixie Cast and Stone Company in Marietta, which was just about 3 miles from where Debbie's body was found, giving investigators a third crime scene. So picking back up in my conversation with Sergeant Nix, he walked me through what authorities discovered about Debbie's abduction as the investigation unfolded.
She was abducted in a laundromat. She was taken to a place which I think is Dixie Cast and Stone. There she was brutally, brutally assaulted. The ME's office said that had he not strangled her, she would have bled to death. She's 65 pounds. It was just a horrific assault. My prayer was that I hope she died quickly. But I knew that she was looking to the face of a monster. Well, he takes her to Dixie Cast and Stone. He assaults her, redresses the body, and takes her right down the road on Powers Ferry Road and dumps her in the wood. It was a wood then. Now it's, you know, it's not. There's an office building there. So I kept trying to figure out what was his motive for doing that. Well, he had taken a rag and placed it in her vaginal area. And the reason I think he did that is because she was bleeding in his vehicle. She was bleeding in his truck. So he had placed a rag there, I think, to keep from bleeding in the vehicle. Well, he takes her right down the road, and I think one of two things happened. He thought, she's bleeding out so much, I need to get her out of my vehicle. Or she wasn't dead. So he stops the vehicle, takes her into the woods, and leaves her body. Her coat had been zipped up to her chin, which I always thought was something about that just in my mind. I couldn't wrap my head around it. But she was found approximately 19 days later by a gentleman named Mike McMahon. Mike was a student at Southern Tech, and they were asking for volunteers to look for Debbie. So his fraternity brothers volunteered, and that's the area that they were assigned. Now, a lot of people asked me, said, well, did you, you know, how about him? Because that's one of the things you do in a case. You know, who discovered the body? Who discovered the crime? I knew Mike Mahon wasn't involved. I just knew it. He had gone to Southern Tech having just arrived in Vietnam. He'd seen a lot of combat in Vietnam. Well, Mike told me that he saw what he thought were drag marks, faint drag marks. So he walked down to investigate, and he saw Debbie's body. He immediately stopped. He didn't walk all the way down there to her, but he stopped, and that's how they found her body.
It was the cloth that Sergeant Nix said William Rose had placed on Debbie's vaginal area and her coat that were submitted for DNA testing in spring 2015. Cold case detectives wanted to know, was it more than one person? What would the DNA reveal about whoever was involved? Now, meanwhile, as the results came in, Sergeant Nix told me he was on his way to a fishing tournament in Alabama. He gets a call from John Dawes, one of the agents on the cold case unit, who says, we've got a profile, but it's a partial profile. And Sergeant Nix said it was like a gut punch. Now, in layman's terms, a partial profile means they couldn't tell who the suspect is, but they could tell who it isn't, which was a start. And Sergeant Nix said it was all they needed to pump life back into the investigation. So he got home from his tournament. He told his wife the news, and he said it was right then and there. He told her, he promised her, I believe with all my heart, this means science and DNA testing are going to advance far enough one day to ID Debbie's killer. Even if it took 5, 10, 20 more years, he wasn't giving up. And in the end, it only took about 7 years. By that point, Cobb County had a new district attorney, and the unit working Debbie's case had dispersed. Sergeant Nix and a few officers, though, of course, kept at it and stayed in almost constant communication. And then last year, Sergeant Nix received the call that changed everything.
He called me back and says, I'll never forget the phone call. I saw who it was, and I said, tell me something good. He said, we know who his sister is. Even now, it's emotional. He said, we're going to take about 3 more weeks, and I think we're going to know exactly who it is. Well, you can imagine what the next 3 weeks were for me. Every time the phone rang, I jumped. And I'm walking the floor at night. I'm like getting on everybody's nerves. I'm trying to stay out of everybody's way, you know, and finally, he calls me one day, and he said, William Rose. Turns out, William, and I've been all over the Southeast, you know, we've run from pillar to post. Turns out, William Rose is buried probably 5 minutes, 10 minutes from my house. Go right by his gravesite all the time. So I talked to Debbie's brother. Now, Debbie's mom and dad had passed since this time, which was one of my deepest regrets, because I had promised them I will never quit. I will never let go of this. And I never wanted to go back on the shelf. There was also a gentleman named Paul Callio. And Paul Callio was kind of taken under the wing early on in this case, when he was still a student. He wrote a term paper in school about Debbie Lynn Randall's case. And Bill Elliott had kind of taken him under his wing, mentored him. And I was stunned at how much he knew about the case. He knew a lot about this case. So, and we had started working with Paul several years ago because I wanted him to be part of it. I knew what it meant to him. And I called Paul Callio, and I don't think Paul would mind me telling you this, but it was another emotional moment. And I couldn't believe it. I mean, it was just, I just couldn't believe it. once I found out who it was, I always swore that when I find out who did this, and I always tried to say when instead of if, when I find out who did this, I'm going to know everything there is to know about him. I'm going to know what his favorite candy bar is. I'm going to know everything there is to know. But strangely, once I knew who it was, I really didn't want to know anything about him. I know who he is. I know a little bit about his background. I know that he committed suicide 2 years after he did the crime. And I tried hard to respect his family. They didn't, you know, they had nothing to do with this. And this whole ordeal took me through a lot of emotion. It took me through a lot of places, a lot of people. So I'm grateful for having been part of it. But there were a lot of tears in these years. I know I can remember Mr. Randall calling me one night, probably about midnight. He was weeping. He was frustrated. He was angry. And he was kind of venting on me, and I understood. I just sat there and listened to him. And I assured him that we were doing everything we could do, that I would not leave anything unturned, and that we were all giving it our best shot. And I said, Mr. Randall, you got to remember, these people aren't getting paid. They're doing this. All those people in that cold case unit, with the exception of one, I think, and donating their time. And we're grateful that we have those people. Great people on the cold case unit, and they were very dedicated. No one solved this case. I did not solve this case. All that I did was keep pushing it forward. That's all that I did. I kept reaching out because I was not going to let it go back on the shelf. As I have said previously, technology solved this case. Technology doesn't sleep, it doesn't get old, it doesn't retire, it doesn't go away. And technology found William Rose in the grave. So I didn't solve anything, and I want everyone to understand that. I've had a couple of people say, well, I understand you solved the Debbie Lynn Randall case. No, I didn't. No, I didn't. All I did was push it forward. So that's that.
Technology found William Rose. Now, that being said, of course, the true crime fan in me was still curious. Throughout the investigation, going all the way back to the day Debbie was abducted in 1972, there were witness statements. One witness, who was 12 at the time, would later recall seeing a man grab Debbie and throw her over his shoulder. She said she regrettably assumed the man was a relative and that Debbie might just be in trouble for something. Who can blame her when she was 12 years old at the time? Another witness remembered seeing a dark-colored pickup truck driving erratically along a road near the laundromat. Now, for those of you listening who are like me, who have listened to countless true crime podcasts, watched every documentary you can imagine, we know that throughout the decades, investigations changed. The 1970s marked an entirely different time for cases like Debbie's. So goes without saying, but resources were so much more limited. Again, backing up a little prior to the DNA match that identified William Rose, I asked Sergeant Nix, what were the questions that haunted him about Debbie's case over the years before they knew about the advances in DNA technology? What did they find out about suspects before they identified William Rose? And then what did they find out about William Rose after they'd identified him? Did he live in the area? Looking at the witness statements, what were some of the red flags in the original investigation from the 1970s? And of course, maybe a little more existential, but what does a cold case investigator go through physically and emotionally?
And I always wondered, did Debbie know him? Did he call her over to the vehicle? But looking at the soap powders, I thought, no, this was a struggle. And I had talked to me, I talked to Debbie's family and said, would Debbie have just cowed down, or do you think she would have just, resisted? And they all said, I think she would have fought. The question that I had was, how did he drive this vehicle, maintain control of Debbie if he was by himself? At one point, I had a guy who confessed to this thing and told me he had two other people with him. He was in prison with a similar history, but it was a fabrication, of which we received many. I had psychics that gave us information. I had four ex-wives that swore their husband did it. And things start coming out, Nicole. You talk to some of these people, and it was heartbreaking to hear them say that it could have been their father because he molested me or my sister. And it would just be gut-wrenching. And what little bit of information we had, we were lucky to have it. So why did William Rhodes commit suicide? I've been asked that a lot. Why do you think? I choose to think that his conscience bothered him to the point, but I really think perhaps he had another victim. He thought it might come out. I don't know. People who do this kind of thing usually don't do it just one time. So I start looking similar cases. We spent a lot of hours looking at that. And I couldn't understand why we could not get anything out of CODIS, the national database. Why am I not getting anything out of CODIS? Surely this guy didn't do this one thing. And I thought, well, perhaps he was convicted, or perhaps he's in another state. And some states back in the early days really weren't that diligent in submitting for CODIS. I thought, well, maybe he was arrested in another state and has been executed. So I start looking at all the people who had been arrested for similar crimes to see if I could get a connection to Marietta. That was a lot of work. I thought perhaps he was arrested in Alabama, Louisiana, somewhere, and got the death penalty. So I started on that, and I worked probably about 3 years working on that. Could not get a hit. I knew that I was looking for a white male. And so a lot of things you do that people just kind of don't realize. People that know me would tell you, it was like always trying to, what am I missing? What am I not seeing that's there? And going back to the original reports, some of the initial reports were pretty good, but there was also a lot missing. When I looked at the case file, the first thing I looked for, one of the very first things that I looked for in this case file, was who lived in those projects at that day, thinking surely there's a list from the housing authority of everybody that lived there. There wasn't. I went to Dixie Cast and Stone, which is still in business. Something I think they're in Austell, Powder Spring. I go there. Amazingly, they're still in business. I talked to the gentleman that owns it now, and that was his mom and stepfather's business. Do you have any payroll records from that day? Do you have anything that we can connect 1972? Did not. But he also told me what I thought. He said, that would have been the perfect place. It was a little winding drive back in the wood. There's some sand pits back there. He said, no one would have heard her. And whoever did this knew that was there. They had been there before. That's why they went there. I've been up and down Powers Ferry Road a million times in high school. I never knew it was back there. He said it would have been the perfect place. One of the big questions too was, and Captain Elliot back in the day would tell you everything about that case, but one thing. He said, there's one thing I'm not telling anybody, because if I ever meet the person who did this, I'm going to let him tell me what it is. Well, we know now that was the shoes that Debbie was wearing. One of the shoes was found at Dixie Casting Stone, and a worker had thrown it away. But it verified what we thought. That would have been the perfect place. And plus, where he dumped the body was less than a quarter mile down the road. But you had to have known it was there. So I'm frantically trying to get a connection to Dixie Casting Stone. I can never verify if William Rose worked at Dixie Casting Stone. But for whatever reason, he knew it was there. When he abducted her, he knew where he was taking her. William Rose's mom lived in the general area of where Debbie lived. And obviously, I think he was riding around looking for that opportunity. He knew those little girls went to that laundromat. He was a predator. And he probably, I'm sure, looked to see if anybody was watching, grabbed her. We went to several states and got DNA, tracking relatives down. We got DNA sample out of Utah on someone's brother, wasn't him. We had another guy who had lived there at the time Debbie lived there. He had prior record, Peeping Tom, and several other offenses. We were told that right after Debbie was killed, he had painted his car with a paintbrush. We spent months investigating this guy. We finally get a DNA sample, and as you can imagine, it wasn't him. We found a guy in Rome, Gainesville, that we spent months working on him. It wasn't him. So there was a lot of highs and lows and failures. But it's a life experience, I can tell you that.
Highs, but so many lows. And I told Sergeant Nix, and I've said it countless times on this podcast, I don't know how anyone in law enforcement, especially cold case units, persevere and do what they do day in and day out.
How do you do it? You know, I've heard agencies say, well, we took this detective off this case because they were too emotionally involved. No such thing. No such thing. Not for the long haul. When you're talking about years and years and years, you have to be involved. And there are certain people who are very determined. And I tell people, there's nothing exciting about this. I mean, there's nothing glamorous. It's not exciting. The great majority of the time, you fail or never figure out, you know, what happened. Our unit was very lucky. We solved like five cases in a very short period of time. We had a good run. We had some good people. I did not come from a homicide background. I had been involved in homicide, but that wasn't really my background. And I've had people say, what makes a good cold case unit? I could get some of everything. Get someone who worked forgery, get someone who worked fugitive, get someone who worked homicide, narcotic, someone who worked in a prison, get a mixture of everything. It's not like working an active homicide case. So you want a little bit of everybody. And we had that on the skull case unit. We had a little bit of everything. And they were all very good. One of the guys on our unit, Tony Gentile, he had been a major in Miami in the homicide narcotics unit. We had a guy with a lot of homicide experience. We had a guy who ran a narcotic unit for 25 years. We had a female on our unit who was a naval commander in intelligence. And we brought her into our unit. She didn't know anything about police work, but she was an analyst. Like I said, she had been a commander. And lot smarter than I am. And we gave her this thing, said, here, do what you can with it. Work. She gave it back to us, and we were amazed. So, yeah, we had a great unit, and I'm proud to have been associated with them. What's left for me, I don't know. Some days I really get the urge to go look at something like that. And other days I think, you know, I need to rest. So we'll see.
And as always, I wanted to end my conversation with Sergeant Nix focusing on Debbie. In talking about her legacy, he told me about Girls Inc. in Marietta, Georgia, a nonprofit focused on in-school, after-school, and summer programs for young girls in the area. They've since dedicated a bench at Girls Inc. to Debbie Lynn Randall. Sergeant Nix was there for the dedication ceremony, and he told me Melvin Randall, Debbie's brother, moved him to tears that day.
At Girls Inc. in Marietta, there's a Debbie Lynn Randall bench. And we had a really nice ceremony, very emotional ceremony. My sister saw it walking across the parking lot and immediately burst into tears. But it's a beautiful bench and a beautiful day. And so that was Debbie's, part of Debbie's contribution. But I told Melvin, I said, Melvin, man, I just can't imagine what you were thinking. Because he was very close to Debbie. He was Debbie's older brother. And Melvin got up in front of this group of people, and he said, I forgive William Rose. He said, I have no hatred in my heart toward William Rose. He said, I have no hatred for his family, and I wish them the best. And he said, I forgive William Rose. He said, I was not going to live the rest of my life with hate. It was a very emotional moment. I did 4 podcasts, I think, with Nancy Grace. And Nancy really, she stepped up and got us a lot of, you know, attention on that case. I'm indebted to Nancy. And It was a community effort.
Sergeant Nix also wanted to end on a note about how he hopes Debbie will be remembered. He wanted to thank everyone involved in closing her case and remind us why and how he hopes her story will impact anyone listening for years to come.
I hope Debbie will be remembered, especially in Marietta. She's just a very normal little girl, and I thank God that we were taken where we were taken. And to all the many, many people that gave me their time and their interviews, and from prisons to the projects to whatever, I thank them, and I'm grateful. I'm grateful to you. And I'm grateful to all the people who have reached out and kind of taken this forward. If I get this book project done, I tell everybody, I'm kind of self-publishing this thing. So you got to all buy 10 books and give them away as Christmas presents or something. So, but that's it. It was just a really pleasure to be with you today. Thank you.
And the last time I spoke with Sergeant Nix, as I was working on our episode, he was almost finished with his book. He's so excited. He said the title is more than likely When the Ice Melts, emphasizing that with Debbie's case, it was a slow melt, 51 years, but the ice did melt. And in Sergeant Nix's words, the emotional toll only made him stronger. This is Beyond Criminal Headlines. My name is Nicole Bennett. Every few weeks, you'll be able to find new episodes on any of your favorite podcast providers featuring conversations between myself and experts who've investigated some of the most notorious crimes in our history. And thank you so much recently for your patience between episodes. I promise I have lots of exciting content planned for 2024. So for those updates and more, you can follow the podcast on Facebook. It's at Beyond Criminal Headlines. And don't forget, wherever you're listening now, give the podcast a follow, rate, review, subscribe, all that good stuff, so you don't miss an episode. I hope you learned something from this week's episode featuring the incredible Sergeant Morris Nix on helping solve the cold case murder of Debbie Lynn Randall. We'll be back again soon. Until next time, this is your host for Beyond Criminal Headlines, Nicole Bennett, signing off.